Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this 4th of July with Trump's military parade underway and discuss a plan to broaden the definition of national security, short of jettisoning the term altogether, with the formation of a new think tank, the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, named after John Quincy Adams, who in a speech on Independence Day in 1821 declared that the U.S., quote, goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She is the champion and vindicator only of her own. A co-founder of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, Colonel Andrew Basevich, who previously taught at West Point and served for 23 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Army, joins us to discuss how the Quincy Institute would invite both progressives and anti-interventionist conservatives to consider a new, less militarized approach to foreign policy and national security in order to redirect our permanent war economy and bring an end to endless and counterproductive wars. By arguing for the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan and the Middle East, returning to the nuclear deal with Iran, adopting a less confrontational approach to Russia and China, Colonel Basevich hopes the Quincy Institute will help restore the pursuit of peace to the nation's foreign policy agenda. Then we will speak with Bill Hing, professor and director of the Immigration and Deportation Defense Clinic and the Dean's Circle Scholar at the University of San Francisco, who just returned from visiting an immigration detention center in Clint, Texas. He joins us to discuss where our nation's values and morality stands as we celebrate America in light of the disgraceful treatment of children in our custody at the southern border by the Trump government, which is acting in our name. With revelations from a Facebook group that reflect a debased culture within the Border Patrol, we will assess the possibility of our better angels overcoming this dark moment brought about by Trump's divisiveness, racism, and cruelty. Then finally, we will investigate where we as a nation stand in terms of economic patriotism as the divide between the rich and poor grows even wider, while most of the rewards go to the 1%, with wages for the middle class and working Americans having remained flat for decades. Sam Pizzagatti, a veteran labor journalist and editor of the online newsletter Too Much and author of The Case for a Maximum Wage, joins us to discuss the extraordinary but accurate observation Bernie Sanders made in the recent presidential candidates' debate that only three American families have a combined wealth equivalent to that of one half of the entire U.S. population. And joining us now is Colonel Andrew Basevich, who's a retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University, who previously taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins University. A graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, he served for 23 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Army and as an author of the New York Times bestsellers Breach of Trust, Washington Rules, and The Limits of Power. His latest book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History, and he is a co-founder of the Quincy Institute for Responsible State Craft. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Basevich. So on this 4th of July, of course, there's quite a bit of controversy about a military parade, which is something that has not happened before. In fact, I think most American presidents throughout our history have sort of retreated on the 4th of July to let people, all Americans, celebrate this country's Constitution and its founding fathers without a military parade, which sort of smacks of the Soviet Union, North Korea, and China, and other dictatorships. How does it strike you?
Well, I have to say that if Barack Obama, rather than Donald Trump, had conceived of this escapade, I think that the media reaction would be much less negative. I think one of the things that's going on here is the absolute disdain for Trump and everything that he does that pervades the mainstream press. That said, even apart from Trump, who I also disdain, by the way, I think perhaps we're making more of this than it deserves. In this sense, it is the case, in my judgment, that, particularly since the end of the Cold War, exploiting the military as a symbol of American greatness has really come to be commonplace. True, not necessarily on 4th of July parades, but in other sort of corners of the culture. I've written about, others have written about how the sort of the inclusion of the military in major sports events, you know, the flyovers of the stadium, the soldiers ringing the outfield of a ball field, the parading of the colors. There has been a militarization of American culture that I think is really ill-advised. And I think that in some senses, this simply represents the further next step along the way. And that's one of the things about Trump. He's so gross that in almost everything he does, he ends up manifesting in a exaggerated sense tendencies that already exist in our politics and in our culture.
Well, Trump, of course, is claiming on Tuesday that the Pentagon and our great military leaders are thrilled to be participating in his 4th of July parade, but the former acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan apparently issued an internal memo to all Pentagon personnel and service members and civilian employees calling on leaders to reinforce the apolitical nature of the U.S. military. My understanding is that General Mattis, the former Secretary of Defense, tried to slow walk this proposal and sort of buried it. But what's your sense about the successes? Now, Shanahan, of course, had to retire because of some rather unpleasant domestic issues. And now his successor, I believe, is a former lobbyist for Raytheon. But he is a military officer, is he not? A former military officer.
He's a graduate of West Point, just as Pompeo is, by the way, and right. They're classmates. But right. to the larger point you are making, I would absolutely endorse efforts to ensure that the United States military remains apolitical, and would condemn anything that seems to compromise the apolitical status of the armed forces. That said, this has been going on for a long time. I mean, going back as far back as Reagan, maybe even before, but I certainly remember with Reagan, presidents have used the troops as a backdrop when they're making speeches or presentations. You know, they choose to go to West Point or to the Naval Academy when making important policy pronouncements. And I think they do that because they calculate, I'm not sure the calculation is correct, they calculate that somehow acting in near, you know, in close connection to the United States military somehow or other endows greater credibility on what they are saying. So yes, this is an egregious example of the politicization of the American military. But again, to repeat the point I made earlier, it's not that what Trump is doing is somehow precedent breaking. Rather, he does things in this particularly egregious way, and therefore we come to recognize more clearly why what he's doing is objectionable.
Well, the word cheesy comes to my mind.
I think you're correct, cheesy.
Cheesy, right. And again, I'm speaking with Colonel Andrew Bacevich, who's a retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University, who previously taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins University, a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy. He served for 23 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Army and is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Breach of Trust, Washington Rules, and The Limits of Power. And his latest book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, a Military History, and he is the co-founder of the Quincy Institute for responsible statecraft. Let's talk about this extraordinary, unusual pair of bedfellows, the liberal George Soros and the libertarian Charles Koch, have got together, and they've organized other funders to underwrite this Quincy Institute, of which you are a co-founder, Andrew Bacevich. And this is an amazing thing for people across the political poles, I guess, to recognize something in common that these forever wars that the United States have been involved in have to end, and that for the longest time, frankly, since World War II, there really hasn't been a definition of national security. There's been a narrow definition of national security, meaning defense, intelligence, etc. But surely there's a broader definition, isn't there? There's the economy, the culture, the society, the soft power, if you will. One of the things I find so extraordinary about the moment we're in is, for all the military bluster that could lead us into another war in the Gulf, which would be a complete catastrophe, what's really working, if that's the right way to put it, to hurt the Iranians is not our military threats, but the treasury and the ability to cut off the transactions that the Iranians need to, or the customers of Iranian oil need. So that's what I find amazing, is that we are in an age where the Treasury Red Notice may have more political power than our nuclear arsenal, but yet we're spending more on defense now, I think, than we ever did. It's $716 billion and going up, and Trump equates our power with how much money we spend. I guess that's the way he thinks, being a real estate guy. So what do you think of this? I mean, you're a part of it, but this seems like a real opportunity to start redefining some basic things like national security, for example. What does that mean?
Well, that was a long and complicated question.
Well,
Let me say this.
Okay.
I'll begin by telling you a little bit about the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. This is a new think tank. We're just getting it off the ground. I am, pleased as punch to be a part of it. Washington is full of think tanks. Most of them, in one way or another, are part of the so-called blob, that is to say, part of the establishment, and therefore part of they buy into a set of propositions that tend to define power and influence in military terms, that tend to think that, military power is our strong suit, that we should put it to work. And the Quincy Institute has a different take. We are against permanent war. We're against war in general. We're not isolationists. We believe in the imperative of the United States engaging the world, engaging others in the world. But we believe that an effective diplomacy is the best way to advance our interests, to advance the possibility of a world that's somewhat peaceful, at least. And we want to participate. We want to become part of the debate over ideas, in hopes of changing the ideas that tend to prevail within that blob. So we need to find money to help us do that. We have succeeded in getting some pretty substantial support from both Soros' foundation and from Charles Koch's foundation. And we sought funding from both the left and the right, because we are committed to the proposition that we are not an instrument of any partisan group. We are nonpartisan or transpartisan. So we want to find support on the left. We want to find support on the right of people and organizations that share our principles. So that's what we're all about. Now, I believe, I would not be involving myself in this if I did not believe, that the present moment offers a considerable opportunity to promote those new, less bellicose ideas, to come to a different definition of statecraft. You were talking about, since World War II, about not having a good understanding of national security. I think I'd just as soon dump that phrase What we want to is to devise a set of principles that can inform American statecraft. Statecraft will always have a military dimension. Now, we're not in favor of disarmament. But why statecraft, it seems to me, puts military power, doesn't put it at the front, puts it in the back, treats it as a last resort, is respectful of war because war is so difficult to control. It tends to produce unintended consequences. So that's what this organization is going to try to do. We have a long way to go because the militarized mindset is deeply embedded in the existing national security establishment. And it's so deep, it's deeply embedded in part because people have a reason to think the way they think. You know, if you're a part of the military-industrial complex, for example, you don't want to see real change in our military posture. But that's what we're trying to do.
Well, clearly there's a more than a coincidence that it's the Quincy Institute. John Quincy Adams made a seminal speech on Independence Day in 1821 when he declared that the United States, quote, goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She is the champion and vindicator only of her own. So,
and that's where we come from.
Uh-huh.
It's the Quincy Institute named after John Quincy Adams. That's correct.
So, but the debate, I was suggesting that we need this new debate, and it looks like your institute may well stimulate it. It's nevertheless comes up, and quite often when we talk about the militarization of our culture and the dominance of our national treasure, with the lion's share going to the military. Paradoxically, though, a lot of the military aren't as warlike as the civilians. On the recent Democratic debate, for example, a presidential debate, a veteran, Tulsi Gabbard, was talking about getting out of Afghanistan and being a soldier and what it's like serving in wars where you don't believe in the mission. And then, of course, a congressman, Ryan, came up with the traditional approach, which is you can't cut and run. So it's sort of staring us in the face. And what's your sense of how to come up with a fresh approach to this somewhat stale argument?
Well, first of all, you know, I think there is a military mindset. Mm-hmm. But the military mindset, not all soldiers subscribe to the military mindset. Indeed, I think it's more commonly the civilians who subscribe to the military mindset, who have a propensity to rely on force. And I think, again, we have to be very careful of generalizations here, but many senior officers, as a result of their own experiences and their study of war, will tend to be somewhat more reticent about using force because they may well have an appreciation of unintended consequences and unexpected costs. And boy, you don't have to look very far in our recent past to understand that. I mean, the war in Iraq started in 2003, an illegal war started in 2003, exemplifies how war can yield other results other than what the proponents of war have promised. So where do we start? I think we start with understanding how the world is changing. You know, the neoconservatives, if in many respects the neoconservatives would be the principal intellectual adversaries of the Quincy Institute, the neoconservatives live in the world of the 1930s and 1940s. They live in a world in which Hitler is out there about to embark upon a genocidal war, and in which only the United States can step up to the plate and prevent bad things from happening. Whether or not that accurately reflects what actually occurred in the 1930s and 1940s is irrelevant, I think, to the world that exists today. Our world is one that has once more become a multipolar order. There is no sole superpower. Our world is one in which, while there certainly are geopolitical challenges, you know, there's a need somehow to find a way for the major powers, China as an example, to coexist with us. But ours is also a world in which we face unprecedented challenges, climate change being a good example, challenges to which traditional approaches to foreign policy are utterly irrelevant. We're not going to be able to deal with climate change until we can create a climate of collaboration between nations in order to address this looming threat. So again, I think the way to begin is to take stock of the world as it is, rather than to pretend that the world is what it once might have been in another era.
Well, just in closing, how do you can this debate there be broadened out to the obvious question of priorities when it comes to the national budget, with the military getting the lion's share and spending more than the top seven other countries on the planet in terms of their military budget, you know, the combined total of the top seven, or those below the United States. And to many, at least, it looks as though what we have is a form of kind of right-wing welfare or corporate welfare. It's not just the military, industrial complex, agribusiness, etc., and that the insanity of filling potholes in Kabul and not filling potholes in Main Street USA, I think, does get to people. But how can you bring that argument in? In other words, I remember having a conversation a while back with Congressman Barney Frank, who served for quite a long time, and he just said, you know, this country will never have health care and all of the stuff that social democracy in Europe take for granted until we deal with the defense budget. So I think it's staring us in the face, isn't it?
Yes. Now, the Quincy Institute is going to focus on foreign policy. But you make a good point, and that is that the implications of foreign policy for every other aspect of American life are huge. And to the extent that we face problems of inequality, your potholes, I mean, more broadly, the problems of our infrastructure, those connect directly to the role that we choose to play in the world and the extent to which we highlight military power as central to that role. So, yeah, it's all of a piece. I'm simply making the point that as far as the Quincy Institute is concerned, we're going to begin with questions related to foreign policy.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us on this 4th of July, Colonel Andrew Bacevich.
Glad to do it. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Colonel Andrew Bacevich, who's a retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University, who previously taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins University, a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy. He served for 23 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Army and is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Breach of Trust, Washington Rules, and The Limits of Power. And his latest book is America's War on the Greater Middle East, A Military History. And he is a co-founder of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back discussing where our nation's values and morality stand as we celebrate America in light of the disgraceful treatment of children in our custody at the southern border.
This is a war we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them and my heroes. I've always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't know.
I'm just a poor wayfaring stranger traveling through this world below. There is no sickness, no toil nor danger in that bright land to which I go.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us on this 4th of July is Bill Hing, who's a professor and director of the Immigration and Deportation Defense Clinic and the Dean's Circle Scholar at the University of San Francisco. He just returned from visiting an immigrant detention center in Clint, Texas. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Hing.
Thank you.
So it may sound a little ironic or odd to be talking about how terrible the United States is treating these young children in our custody. This is a collective guilt that we have because it's being done in our name. And this is a day, of course, where we're celebrating our freedom and our values. So having just experienced and witnessed how the United States government under President Trump are treating these young children on the border, how are you feeling on this 4th of July?
I'm not feeling very good. What I experienced will never escape my mind. It's a shameful situation that manifests a cruelty that I never imagined I would ever see. I've been doing immigration law since the 1970s. I've been through a lot. I've been to other detention centers, family detention centers, which I thought were the worst that I've ever seen. But when I saw a children detention center where kids have been there for 2 to 3 weeks, left to take care of themselves, a two-year-old left to take care of herself, I'm still in shock, to be honest with you.
Well, what was even more shocking, and to my mind, I know not really more shocking, but sort of compounding the horror and shame of what's going on the border, is when our representatives, our congresspeople, went down there to do their oversight and to investigate as they are supposed to do. And normally, you know, when a delegation from Congress is showing up, whatever the government agency that's being inspected, you know, spruces the place up. But these people didn't seem to do that. They treated Ocasio-Cortez quite rudely, the Border Patrol. And when she and Congressman Julian Castro had a press conference outside these detention facilities, local people down there in Texas, I guess, who were supporters of President Trump, heckled them when they were doing their press conference. So this is really turning ugly, isn't it?
It's ugly. I cannot believe the hecklers. I cannot believe that they didn't even clean up the place that much for the members of Congress. In fact, they got to tour the facilities. My inspection group did not. We could interview any child we want to that was on a list of more than 350 children in detention at that time, but we couldn't walk around, whereas they were able to walk around and they saw no running water, that kind of thing. But that was shocking. And you're right, the fact that hecklers, and then I'm sure you're aware of the Border Patrol Facebook page just mocking the deaths of people, it's totally unbelievable.
And again, I'm speaking with Bill Hing, who's a professor and director of the Immigration and Deportation Defense Clinic and the Dean's Circle Scholar at the University of San Francisco. He just returned from visiting an immigrant detention center in Clint, Texas. Now, when you just mentioned the Facebook group of roughly 9,500 former Border Patrol and currently serving Border Patrol people who have been sharing the most outrageous comments referring to immigrants as scumbuckets, hoes, making fun of people, immigrants being forced to drink out of toilets. By the way, Rush Limbaugh also made the most outrageous remarks about that as well. I just don't understand why people are piling on. And just recently, on the front pages of newspapers all around the world, there was the most shocking and heartbreaking picture of a young Salvadoran father face down in the Rio Grande with his dead 2-year-old child with her arm around her father's neck. And this was a heartbreaking picture. And what happens in these Facebook posts by the Border Patrol people? They call these people, these victims, floaters. They think it's funny.
Well, unfortunately, that represents some of the Border Patrol officers that I've encountered over the years. And of course, we'd be overstating it to say that they're all like that. They're certainly not all like that. But the fact that some of them feel licensed to engage in that kind of mockery is outrageous, and they have to be held accountable. Yes, they are law enforcement officials, but they have to meet a certain standard of dignity and care and responsibility. And those types of comments do not reflect the standards that the Border Patrol should upkeep.
And to be fair, the Border Patrol head has announced an investigation and promised some punishment. But who's giving license to do this? I would suggest that the President of the United States, Donald Trump, is giving license, and along with, of course, his advisor, Stephen Miller. Isn't it a deliberate policy of President Trump to be cruel? Isn't that the policy? In other words, we're just going to make life so miserable for these immigrants coming up from Central America who have claimed asylum. We're just going to make life so miserable that even worse than the conditions that they're fleeing from. And this way we'll deter the flow of migration. That seems to be the strategy. And as far as I can tell, President Trump has no conscience in this regard and doesn't feel bad about it. And unfortunately, it looks like his followers don't feel bad about it either. So is that really the way to look at this, that this is a deliberate form of cruelty being meted out by our own government as a strategy to deter migrants from coming to the United States across the southern border?
I honestly, none of us can guess exactly what's going through the president's mind. It's clear that he has said that he's trying to implement a policy of deterrence. Could that policy have anticipated this outcome where people who are so desperate, fleeing violence, fleeing just awful situations, and I've seen it. I was in Honduras in March. I was in Tijuana at the end of February talking with caravan members. These are not folks that are coming here to go visit Disneyland. These folks are coming here out of desperate circumstances. Could he have anticipated that it would lead to these circumstances of this man being caught by this waiting list system that some refer to as a metering system, and out of desperation trying to ford the river? Yes, I think a reasonable person could have anticipated that type of action, but we know that our president is not a reasonable person. Should he know? Yes, he should know that this is not the answer. And any leader with a semblance of a heart would not be treating children especially this way, not much less their parents. I agree with you that I cannot believe that Republicans have stood by largely and not voiced an outcry over this situation. I kind of understand, although I also don't tolerate it, I kind of understand when Republicans stand by and don't criticize him for certain things because they want their Supreme Court nominees, or they want to attack Obamacare, or they want some conservative economic policy. But when it comes to immigration policy and the lack of humanity that's being demonstrated, I have totally lost faith in the Republican Party for being so gutless to not stand up to this man.
And just in the last couple of minutes on this 4th of July, broadening the conversation out to the kind of national psyche, if you will, or the national zeitgeist, there was a recent book by the historian John Meacham calling upon the better angels of our nature. It does seem that, certainly from what we're talking about and what we've witnessed in terms of the cruelty and the people that support the president's cruel policies and make fun of the pain that's being inflicted upon these innocent children who are literally in our custody. The Bible makes it real clear that you're supposed to take care of people in your custody, and you're supposed to care for the stranger. And there's the parable of the Good Samaritan. So how much are we have we fallen from grace? I mean, how do you see it in that broad context?
I never thought we would reach these low depths. I've witnessed gun-toting immigration raids. I've witnessed the family detention with women and children on their laps in a different detention center in Texas, in Dilley, Texas. But when I walked into this place in Clint, Texas, and saw a four-year-old boy with filthy clothes, dirty hair, unwashed, the younger the child, the more dirty and unkempt they were, I said to myself, this can't be true. We can't be at this point in our state of history. And I'm constantly shaking my head over it. This has got to end. This is so inhumane.
And how does it end? I mean, as far as I can tell, it has to end at the ballot box in 2020.
You're absolutely right, because the court that is overseeing these conditions, that judge will order that this be cleaned up. Then a few months from now, things are going to happen again, and another inspection team is going to unearth other things. And this isn't going to end. This is Trump's strategy, and this will not end until Mr. Trump is no longer in office.
Well, Bill Hing, I thank you very much for joining us on the 4th of July.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Bill Hing, who's a professor and director of the Immigration and Deportation Defense Clinic and the Dean's Circle Scholar at the University of San Francisco. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into where our nation stands in terms of economic patriotism.
Our choices here are growing. As children grow, they grow with what they see. And in these times where paranoia closes in, power and hate are ravaging disease. In our minds we build the blocks to what we need. In our minds we're reaching out for peace. In our hearts we know of such the hills to climb. In our hearts a sense of master feed.
There's a place out on the edge of town, sir, rising above the factories and the fields. Ever since I was a child, I can't remember the mansion on the hill.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us on this 4th of July is Sam Pizzicati, who's a veteran labor journalist, an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and an editor at the online newsletter Too Much. His books include The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class, and most recently, The Case for a Maximum Wage. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Pizzicati.
Thank you.
So, Sam, I think this is an encouraging political season. Obviously, we're early in the presidential election sweepstakes, but at this point, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are certainly pretty high up there in the polls for what the polls are worth at this early stage. Do you see a kind of an awakening in this country in terms of economic patriotism?
Well, yes, I do. I think what we're seeing now, we're seeing more momentum for egalitarian change in the United States than we've seen at any time since FDR sat in the White House. So to me, it's someone who's been following this closely for the past 30 years, this is a very encouraging moment.
And what do you make of the fact that some of the plutocrats, some of the wealthiest Americans, are now talking about income inequality and even paying more taxes. Eli Broad recently had an op-ed saying, I'm in the 1%, please raise my taxes. And we've also heard from Abigail Disney, whose grandfather, Roy Disney, was a co-founder of the Disney, you know, multi-billion dollar empire. What do you make of that?
Well, there are two ways you could react to that. One way would be to belittle what's just happened. After all, only 18 billionaires signed that letter calling for a wealth tax, and you add Eli Broad to that, that's 19 people. That adds up to about 3% of the billionaires in the United States today. So it's clearly not a majoritarian sense, and it's easy to pass that off as an insignificant gesture. But on the other hand, if we look back a century to the first battle, to the first campaign against America's original plutocracy in the original Gilded Age, we see that there were class traitors back then too. Men like the famed newspaper publisher E.W. Scripps, the founder of the first giant media chain in the United States. You had these class traitors like E.W. Scripps back over a century ago calling for taxes on the rich, and there were only a small number of them, but they created the makings of a class alliance that helped push through measures that really did knock down that first plutocracy. So I'm glad to see these billionaires taking action, and I'm glad to see organizations like Patriotic Millionaires, which is a group of obviously millionaires who've been working the past several years to tax the rich. And last month, they sponsored a conference in Washington along that line that drew a cross-class alliance that was very encouraging to see. So overall, I'm happy to see this development.
But I think if you were to have a movement to empower economic patriotism, I think you have to not just attack income inequality, but you've got to, I think, make the point, or the larger point, that we should all in this country have a stake in the country. I detect political alienation. You certainly can see it on the right with Trump's populist right-wing insurgency. That was largely driven by resentment, by a feeling that people had been, that globalization had passed them by and that they were the victims of and of course they blamed it all on minorities and whatever, labor unions, you name it. But it's still there. There's this alienation that you have on the populist right, but you also have it on the political left, the sense that terrible things have been done by the government and it's not my government and they've been lying to me all my life. That kind of stuff that I get in many, many letters from listeners. It's your country, for God's sake. Take it back. Isn't that a part of what should be engendered here in economic patriotism?
Well, when we have a plutocracy, and a plutocracy is ruled by the rich, then the government ceases to be a government of people. So the sorts of reactions that you've just outlined, you've just described, they make sense when we don't have a government that belongs to the people. We have a government that belongs to the rich, and I think the struggle against that rich dominance of our governing institutions is crucial to any building of economic patriotism, any sense that this country is ours and it's worth participating in.
So I would think, though, in terms of mobilizing people, not that they need to really be reminded of income inequality. I mean, I know Bernie Sanders does. In fact, on the recent Democratic presidential debates, he said that 3 Americans own half the wealth. And there have been some talk, but maybe that's a little inaccurate. As far as I know, it is accurate, isn't it?
Yes, it's absolutely accurate. In fact, it comes from a report out of the think tank where I'm an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. We crunched all the data, and the richest three families in the United States have more wealth than the bottom 50% of the United States. That's the state that we've come to in the United States.
So is that Bezos, the Waltons, and the Gates family?
Mm-hmm.
Are they
mm-hmm.
the three?
Yes, those are the three.
Bezos, Waltons, and Gates.
And globally now, we have three individuals globally with fortunes over $100 billion. And that's the first time we've ever had that sort of concentration globally.
Well, I don't know that Bezos is a philanthropist in the sense. I think he wants to... He's spending money on getting to Mars or something, which seems like a massive waste of money and leaving behind all the problems on this planet in order to go off and live in a bubble, a dome, in a lifeless planet. I'm not sure about that one. But Gates, him and his wife, seem to be fairly philanthropic, and I think they've made a deal, haven't they, with the other billionaire, Berkshire Hathaway?
Warren Buffett.
Warren Buffett, right, to give money...
Yes, and they have given money, but that's problematic as a growing literature on the critical literature on philanthropy has shown, because those deep pockets like Gates and people like him give money to causes that make sense to them, and what makes sense to them is not something that makes sense to the vast majority of people. So Gates, for instance, has contributed millions to education reform, and his education reform the projects that he's funded have been a disaster for public education across the country. They've sort of nurtured the charter school movement, which is now a real threat to public education in terms of siphoning off funds from real public schools and putting them in the hands often in the hands of for-profit operators who don't have the best interest of kids always in mind. So I in a democracy, the majority of people are supposed to decide public policy. Public policy is not supposed to be decided in democracy by the whims of a few super rich people. And more, that's what we're seeing to be the case.
Well, the third family in this triumvirate of three families that own as much or more wealth than the bottom half of the entire population of the United States, the Gates, Bezos, the Waltons, the heirs to the Walmart family, who again were just lucky in birth, they give, as far as I know, they're quite reactionary in their philanthropy, and they give an awful amount of money to charter schools as well. But then on the other, you know, you do have the Sackler family, the owners of Purdue Pharma, who literally created the OxyContin, the opioid addiction crisis in this country, and they have the blood of what? Hundreds of thousands, at least 100,000 Americans.
More than that. Yeah. More than that. It's the life expectancy for males in the United States has actually gone down in many economic categories over the last 3 years. A direct testament to the fatal reaction to the drugs that the families like the Sacklers have done so much to propagate.
So they really bring us back to the kind of, you know, in other words, that explodes the myth of the largesse of the billionaires, the good billionaires. I mean, they're the poster people for the bad billionaires, right?
Right. But you know, even when we have billionaires who give money to good causes, what everybody would agree to good causes, even then we have an unhealthy situation. Consider the Koch brothers, who've contributed to all sorts of right-wing reactionary causes. They've also given some money to straightforward cancer research. But what's the impact of that? Billionaires like those, they give money to some, you know, absolutely worthy causes that everybody would agree are worthy, and that gives them sort of the psychological armor to continue in their business lives, to take exploitative measures that build their fortunes, because they say the bigger my fortune is, the more I can give money to, quote, good causes. So they continue to wreak havoc in people's lives by charging too much for prescription drugs or for whatever the main driving force of their business fortune may be. They use those philanthropical dollars that they give as a self-justification for the horrors they're committing in the economy.
Well, the Koch brothers, you know, they're in the oil business, oil refining,
yes.
Pipelines.
Yes.
They are the ones that have put these absolute criminals in charge of the EPA. One of their proteges is the Secretary of State, Pompeo. They have other proteges in this kind of team of grifters in the Trump cabinet. And their job is to just to do everything against the mission of whatever department they're in charge of. And, you know, you could hold the Kochs responsible for actually causing cancer. So they can't have it both ways. You can't give money to cancer research at the same time by the politicians to allow you to pollute, which causes cancer.
That's
so
right. But it's pretty bizarre. But you can justify in your own mind, if you're a Koch, you can justify in your own mind what you're doing on the ground in the real economy on the basis that you're helping people find a cure for cancer, the very cancer in reality that you're doing so much to help create.
Well, on this 4th of July, let's sort of turn to what can be done to engender economic patriotism. What, in terms of policies, can be enacted? For example, in Japan, they have a form of economic patriotism. I don't think it's written in the law, but it's a part of their customs and cultures that the top CEOs of their corporations cannot be paid thousands of times more than the average worker, which is the case in the United States. The multiples in the United States are absolutely obscene. Tens of thousands more times do the CEOs get paid than the people on the shop floor. There's also, in Germany, for example, every major corporation has at least, I think, half of the board members representing labor on the board of directors. And you have to admit that Germany has a very successful economy and an extremely successful export economy. So having representatives of organized labor on the board is clearly not destroying these companies. But in this country, the plutocrats and the corporate heads have all but destroyed collective bargaining. Unions are under constant assault, and now they've stacked the Supreme Court with these anti-union people like Kavanaugh and particularly Gorsuch.
That's very true. There are some very concrete steps that we can take. Some specific sorts of legislative initiatives that we can push that could help mobilize a move toward what you're describing as economic patriotism by attacking what the quality that corporate America is building each and every day, each and every year. We can stop the expenditures of our tax dollars. We can stop sending our tax dollars to corporations that are making inequality worse by paying their top executives many, many, many times more than what they pay their typical workers. In 2017, we now know from the latest statistics, 33 U.S. corporations paid their CEOs over 1,000 times more than they paid their most typical workers. 33 corporations. I mean, that's astounding. 40 years ago, the typical CEO of a major corporation in the United States only made 30 times more than the corporation's average workers. So what can we do? Well, we can deny government contracts to corporations that pay their executives over 50 times what they pay their most typical workers. We can deny government subsidies, corporate welfare, to any company that overpays its top executives as compared to its workers. We can tax corporations with wide CEO worker pay ratios at much higher rates than we tax corporations with modest differentials between executives and workers. Steps like these would build into our system the sort of idea that you have in Japan, where top executives only make a fraction of what top executives in the United States make. And as a result, Japan is a much more equal country than the United States. And interestingly, I mean, the historical thing that's really interesting to me is that Japanese system that they have now, we created after World War II. During the occupation of Japan, we essentially eliminated the old corporate executive ruling class in Japan, and we cleared the way for engineers and people who actually did work in corporations to become the top executives. And the ratios they had, the pay ratios they had in their corporations, were all modest. So we in the United States created that basis for Japanese equality. We need to do the same back home here in the United States.
Well, just in the last minute, one of the great ironies here in the United States is that successful blue states that are liberal subsidize unsuccessful red states that are conservative. The most egregious example is Mitch McConnell's state of Kentucky. Kentucky gets 40% more in tax dollars than they pay into the Treasury. And yet McConnell, of course, passes laws, and not that he passes anything nowadays in the Senate, to hurt people in California and New York like they did with the taking away the deduction for state and local taxes. So I find that deeply ironic. Is there anything that can be done to undo that? Why should we here in California subsidize Mitch McConnell, for God's sake?
Well, I think the further irony is that Mitch McConnell is subsidizing the elites in states like California and New York with his national policies, his national tax policies, and his national policies in other area. So to me, it's not a struggle between states as it is so much a struggle between classes. Frankly, Mitch McConnell is not on the side of average people in Kentucky. He's on the side of elites, of the rich and powerful, wherever they may live in the United States.
Yeah, but he gets taxpayer dollars to do trickle-down economics and pork barrel, so he stays in power. And the elites in California now have to pay more in taxes just because the Republicans are mean and punitive.
Yes, California has a higher state tax, income tax, than states like Kentucky.
Most
certainly does. Yeah. But the elites in California are paying considerably less in total taxes thanks to the national tax cut that McConnell engineered.
But they, at the same time, they have to pay more in state. They no longer have the state and local tax deduction. That's across the board. So.
Right.
I don't know whether, of course, the elites can always afford more than the average folks. I thank you for joining us here on this 4th of July, Sam Pizzagatti.
Thank you, and happy 4th.
Same to you. And again, I've been speaking with Sam Pizzagatti, who's a veteran labor journalist and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and an editor of the online newsletter Too Much. His books include The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class, and most recently, The Case for a Maximum Wage. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Angela.